for Leologos Radio, the weekly radio program featuring the best in Greek music and culture, plus interviews with Greek and international newsmakers. Leologos Radio with Michael Nevaralekis begins now. That was Dimitris Mitropanos starting off a new season of Leologos Radio with Proto Phthinoporo. This is Leologos Radio, the Greek radio program which is heard worldwide on 23 radio stations across 5 countries, 4 continents, and online. And we would like to welcome our new listeners in Joplin, Missouri on KXMS 88.7 FM and in Melbourne, Australia on 3XY. My name is Michael Nevradakis, and on today's broadcast we will kick off the new broadcast season with an interview as part of the Leologos interview series featuring Professor Deborah Berman Santana, who is returning to our program today to share with us the latest developments as far as the economic crisis of Puerto Rico and to analyze the many similarities she saw with the case of Greece based on her recent stay in Greece this past summer. This interview will be followed up by our commentary of the week, and you will hear some great Greek music as well. Coming up now, though, is the Diálogos interview series. The Diálogos interview series, our weekly segment featuring interviews on matters pertaining to Greece and the worldwide Greek community, coming up next here on Diálogos Radio. Joining us today on Diálogos Radio in the Diálogos interview series is Deborah Berman Santana, recently retired professor of geography and ethnic studies at Mills College in Oakland, California. Deborah will speak to us about the latest economic and political developments in Puerto Rico, which is facing an economic crisis similar to that in Greece, and she will discuss the similarities that she has seen between Puerto Rico and Greece after spending some time in Greece recently. Deborah, welcome to our program today.
Thank you.
Getting us started, describe for us the history of the economic exploitation of Puerto Rico. What has the impact of colonialism been on Puerto Rico's economic viability?
Well, colonies exist so that the colonized will benefit economically and politically. Since the United States invaded and occupied Puerto Rico in 1898, it has extracted profit in numerous ways. First, through converting it into a sugar colony. Then after World War II, Puerto Rico was transformed through Operation Bootstrap into a special economic zone to benefit U.S. corporations under the guise of development via export-led industrialization. As a captive market, Puerto Rico also became home to, for example, the most Walmarts per square meter in the world. Finally, Puerto Rico's colonial neither U.S. state nor independent state political status allowed U.S. bond market to give special exemptions to investors, which has brought Puerto Rico to its current debt crisis. Now, during the 1930s, the anti-imperialist congressman Vito Marcantonio sponsored a study which revealed that since 1898, U.S. corporations had extracted as much as $400 billion in profits from Puerto Rico. And recently, independent researchers in Puerto Rico have estimated that since the 1950s, more than $500 trillion has been extracted from Puerto Rico. Both estimates encompass the free usage of Puerto Rican resources and the restriction via U.S. cabotage laws requiring all imports and exports to use U.S. merchant marine ships and U.S. crews. So it would not be an exaggeration to say that the United States has taken more than $1 trillion away from its colony, which certainly dwarfs Puerto Rico's $73 billion public debt.
We are speaking with Professor Deborah Berman Santana here on Diálogos Radio and the Diálogos interview series. And Deborah, how did this ongoing exploitation contribute to the present-day debt crisis in Puerto Rico? And what has been the role of Washington, Wall Street, and the so-called vulture funds in perpetuating this crisis?
Well, with the eventual elimination of industrial tax incentives in Puerto Rico beginning in the 1990s, Puerto Rico's governments increasingly looked to loans to balance its budget and continue practices of rewarding political cronies with contracts for large infrastructure projects. Subsequently, President Clinton's elimination of the Glass-Steagall Act allowed for investment bankers to increasingly engage in bond market speculation. Puerto Rico received triple exemption because of its colonial status, which meant that every pension fund and every municipal and state government, among others, bought Puerto Rico bonds, ignoring the fact that its economy began shrinking once the special industrial exemptions were completely eliminated in 2006. Now, the election of a protege of the Koch brothers, Luis Fortunio, as Puerto Rico's governor in 2008 resulted in a bitter medicine law that eliminated tens of thousands of public jobs, which accelerated the descent of the economic recession into a depression. By 2011, the major credit agencies began degrading Puerto Rico's ratings, with the result that it increasingly resorted to short-term high-interest loans similar to payday loans. bondholders increasingly unloaded their Puerto Rico bonds in the secondary bond market, which were then swooped up by vulture funders such as Paul Singer and John Paulson, often at 10 to 20% of the bond's value. Today, these vulture funders possess up to 50% of Puerto Rico's public debt and are the creditors who are the least willing to renegotiate the terms of the loans. They have been the major lobbyists so far for the congressional law, which was known as PROMESA, that recently became law.
PROMESA has been touted by some as a bailout for Puerto Rico. What does this bill actually mean for Puerto Rico, though, in your view, and what is the significance of the acronym that was used, PROMESA?
The new law, which President Obama signed on June 30th, is entitled the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act, or PROMESA. In Puerto Rican popular parlance, a PROMESA is a pledge that someone makes when dealing with a family crisis. The person promises to do something for the community if the crisis is resolved. Often this is an annual fiesta, including traditional music, food and drink, and it may last for decades. That the U.S. Congress would give this name to a law that strips away any pretense of self-government has caused a tremendous amount of resentment in Puerto Rico. This law allows President Obama to appoint a 7-member board paid for by the Puerto Rican people, which will take control of the budget, eliminate environmental laws, dismiss public employees, abolish public agencies, and cut minimum wage by half for young workers, close schools and hospitals, increase utility bills, and cut pensions. These measures are justified by the priority of making payments on the public debt. There is no provision for economic development or for restructuring the public debt, let alone canceling it. There is no acknowledgement that such measures are likely to greatly increase emigration of working age Puerto Ricans while severely deteriorating the quality of life for those who remain. And any bailout that might occur as a result seems directed only at the Wall Street vultures, who now control most of the debt. Now, on August 31st, President Obama announced the names of the members of the junta. Four were born in Puerto Rico. Two of those were in the governments of the former Puerto Rican governor, Fortunio. And one of them, Carlos Caco Garcia, and his nickname is used in Puerto Rico to refer to criminals, was directly involved in the bitter medicine law that of 2009 that began massive layoffs of public employees, and was also responsible for billions of dollars of short maturity bonds that have now virtually bankrupted the Government Development Bank. Now, were it not for such actions, it's possible that the PROMESA law would not have been enacted. So was he named to cover up the tracks of his patrons? Certainly he was not chosen for physical responsibility. And among the other three junta members is Andrew Biggs, who is known for crusading in favor of privatizing Social Security and other public pension funds. So it's not difficult to imagine what role he will likely play in Puerto Rico.
We are on the air with Professor Deborah Berman Santana here on the Diálogos Radio and the Diálogos interview series. And Deborah, there's a lot that has been written about the economic crisis in Puerto Rico recently, including a report by the Committee for the Abolition of Illegitimate Debt, CEDTM, which has also written about the Greek debt in the past as well. What do you make of these reports, and were there any Puerto Rican economists that were given the opportunity to provide their own input into these reports?
Well, CEDTM's article was odd in that it did not appear to be any effort to read up or try to understand Puerto Rico, but simply to use information from Europe and elsewhere and change names where needed. For example, it referred to Puerto Rico as a member of the Commonwealth of the United States, an entity that does not exist, unlike, for example, the British Commonwealth. Puerto Rico is actually defined by the United States as a territory belonging to, but not a part of the United States, with not a single iota of sovereignty. A White House report on Puerto Rico in 2006 claimed that the U.S. could give Puerto Rico away to another country should it choose to do so. And the term Commonwealth is used for Puerto Rico to give the illusion that Puerto Rico achieved some form of self-governance in the United Nations, removing it from their list of colonies. Now, there has been a movement to get Puerto Rico reinstated to that list for decades. Another weakness of CEDTM's analysis was its use of secondary sources of statistics about Puerto Rico such as the Pew Foundation, instead of Puerto Rico's own government or any of several Puerto Rican independent research institutes. Perhaps most egregious of all is that it doesn't mention the fact that as a colony with no sovereignty, all of Puerto Rico's public debt may be considered illegal. One might presume that an international organization dedicated to cancellation of debt would know that it was a successful insistence by the United States in 1898 that Cuba did not need to pay any of its colonial debt because it was contracted by Spain. That helped shape the concept of odious debt. I am not sure of the purpose of the CADTM article, and I hesitate to call it a report other than to jump on the Puerto Rico misinformation bandwagon.
In what ways has the colonial administration of Puerto Rico made the island economically dependent on the United States, and how does this dependency impact the national psyche of Puerto Ricans?
There used to be a geography book written by a North American named Muller, which was the first textbook studied in all Puerto Rican schools. The first sentence read, "Puerto Rico is a small, overpopulated, poor island, lacking in natural resources, which cannot survive without the United States." Puerto Rico has served in a laboratory for generations of U.S. academics, most of whom were awarded government and foundational grants to prove that Puerto Rico and its people were geologically, biologically, and socially inferior. Their claims were often absurd, such as that Puerto Ricans were afraid of the sea and that there are hardly any fish in the surrounding Caribbean, both of which could be easily disproved. Or that somehow Puerto Rico's rich soils could not feed the population, which was not the case until most arable land was diverted to sugarcane and then later covered in cement for the industrialization strategy. Puerto Ricans were constantly told to look for the United States for all sources of innovations and progress, and warned that independence would be economically and socially disastrous. There's a favorite slogan here, "Where would we be without her?" alongside the U.S. flag. Never mind that all of the disastrous economic and social consequences about which we were warned have occurred precisely because of our colonial relationship to the United States. So you simply cannot extract the amount of profits from a country that the United States has taken from Puerto Rico, plus restrict Puerto Rico's ability to protect its own resources or capital, and expect to have a positive economic result.
We are speaking with Professor Deborah Berman Santana here on the Diálogos Radio in the Diálogos interview series. And Deborah, describe for us the political system of Puerto Rico, the major political parties, and to what extent the island enjoys any degree of self-governance.
Well, for the first 50 years after the U.S. invasion of Puerto Rico, the president named the governor and most directors of government agencies. Since the establishment of the Associated Free State, or Commonwealth, in 1952, Puerto Rico has elected its own governor and legislature, as well as a non-voting representative to the U.S. Congress. Elections are held every 4 years, and there are two majority parties. One is the pro-statehood New Progressive Party, or PNP, and the Popular Democratic Party, PPD, which favors the current status with greater autonomy. The Puerto Rican Independence Party, known as PIP, once was the second largest party, but it's been relegated by decades of political repression and extreme factionalism among pro-independence and left organizations to the status of a very small party that barely manages to elect some representatives at municipal and island-wide levels. There is also a Puerto Rican court system which uses Spanish and is based on Roman law, as is true of Latin American countries, which, however, is subordinate to the English-only U.S. federal court located in the U.S. federal building in San Juan, which is a concrete reinforced stronghold that is the official seat of U.S. colonial rule. The Puerto Rican government has not had the power to truly protect local businesses against product dumping from U.S. companies, nor to make economic treaties with other countries without U.S. approval. However, it has had control over its budget and taxes, which both majority parties have used to curry political favor with contractors and corporate sponsors. This has encouraged a culture of corruption, which would appear to confirm the dominant narrative that Puerto Ricans lack the capacity to properly govern themselves. But at no time since 1898 has any Puerto Rican government been able to exercise sovereign decision-making against the wishes of Washington. That the so-called Commonwealth did not change its status was confirmed by two rulings of the U.S. Supreme Court this last June, one of which dealt with Puerto Rico's exemption from use of Chapter 9 bankruptcy, while at the same time nixing its government's attempt to write its own bankruptcy law. Briefly, the Supreme Court affirmed that Puerto Rico lacked even the limited sovereignty that a U.S. Indian tribe might possess, and that Puerto Rico's constitution had about as much validity as the Puerto Rican peso had after the U.S. takeover. In addition, President Obama said that there is no alternative to the PROMESA bill, and that the imposition of a junta, which of course means that the Puerto Rico's elected government, laws, and constitution really mean nothing.
What do you make of the summertime visit of presidential candidate Bernie Sanders to Puerto Rico, and what came out of this visit?
Well, Senator Sanders' primary campaign strategy in the United States was to attract independent voters to vote for him in the primaries. Now, even though Puerto Ricans and other residents of U.S. colonies do not vote for president and have no voting representation in Congress, they do have delegates to the Democratic and Republican conventions, and so they usually do hold primaries. By far the largest of the colonies in terms of population is Puerto Rico. And so Sanders' strategy was to encourage independentistas who support independence and who do not vote in U.S. primaries to vote for him. In his congressional career, Sanders had never appeared to be aware of Puerto Rico's existence. Yet suddenly he was promoted as a savior who would decolonize Puerto Rico, all based upon his criticism of Wall Street and his supposed reputation as a radical leftist. Now, Sanders never could bring himself to mention the C word, colony, when speaking about his country's relationship with Puerto Rico. More than once, he referred to Puerto Rico as a protectorate. And his harshest words accused Washington of using the PROMESA bill to, quote, treat Puerto Rico as a colony, without, of course, admitting that Puerto Rico already is a colony. Unfortunately, colonies foster colonized mentalities. So Sanders did manage to divide independentistas yet again, when what is most needed at this time is unity. Sanders introduced an alternative bill to PROMESA in the Senate, only after PROMESA had already been approved by the House of Representatives and was endorsed by Obama, so that his bill did not even get a proper hearing. The proposed bill itself was a hodgepodge of measures that may have been marginally better in economic terms than PROMESA, but it also included a section on holding yet another referendum on political status, though at least five have already been held. Now, this bill provided detailed instructions on how to fast-track statehood, should that option win, but it had nothing about U.S. responsibility for ensuring free determination and indemnification for eventual independence. And I should also add that many U.S. politicians, from George Bush and Ted Kennedy to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, have made extravagant promises while campaigning for Puerto Rican delegates to their party's conventions. So in sum, Sanders used Puerto Rico exactly as have other U.S. politicians before him.
This is the Alawis Radio. We will return after a short break.
Την Ανδαλουσία πέφτει στα μαύρα της μαλλιά. Βάζει φωτιά στη φαντασία, κλέβει απ' τα χείλη της φιλιά. Τριάντα φυλάκια απ' τη Σεβίλη ανθίζει μες στο χαλασμό. Φορά της Κάρμεν το μαντίλι στον αλαβάστρινο λαιμό. Κι όπως χορεύει με ταξιδεύει μια γειτονιά ο κόσμος, απ' την Ελλάδα ως τη Γρανάδα ένα φεγγάρι δρόμος. Όπως χορεύει με ταξιδεύει μια γειτονιά ο κόσμος. Απ' την Ελλάδα ως τη Γρανάδα ένα φεγγάρι δρόμος. Μες στο τσιγκάνο τα τσαντήρια χτυπά τα πόδια τη στιγμή. Ράγισουν όλα τα ποτήρια και βάφουν με αίμα την αυγή. 30 φυλάκια απ' τη Σεβίλη ανθίσει μες στην παγωνιά. Κι ο ουρανός την έχει στείλει να γίνει φως στη σκοτεινιά. Κι όπως χορεύει με ταξιδεύει μια γειτονιά ο κόσμος. Απ' την Ελλάδα ως τη Γρανάδα ένα φεγγάρι δρόμος. Όπως χορεύει με ταξιδεύει μια γειτονιά ο κόσμος. Απ' την Ελλάδα ως τη Γρανάδα ένα φεγγάρι δρόμος. Απ' την Ελλάδα ως τη Γρανάδα ένα φεγγάρι δρόμος.
We now return to the Diálogos interview series here on Diálogos Radio. We are on the air with Professor Deborah Berman Santana here on Diálogos Radio and the Diálogos interview series. And Deborah, how is the issue of independence viewed in Puerto Rico today, and how has Washington typically responded to the independence movement?
Well, there have been independence movements in Puerto Rico ever since the 19th century, when Spain was still the colonial power. Since the 1898 invasion, Washington has combined violent repression of independence groups with selective co-option of broad sectors of Puerto Rican society, using, for example, church officials and entrepreneurs, politicians and civil society leaders to divide Puerto Ricans against each other while promoting Uncle Sam as the benefactor. Neighbors were paid to spy and report on every aspect of the lives of independent supporters, while many lost their jobs or were expelled from the university. Leaders were often arrested on a variety of charges, and many served long prison sentences. And not even leaving Puerto Rico for the diaspora exempted them for persecution. For example, Oscar Lopez Rivera is currently imprisoned, having served 35 years of a 55-year sentence for, quote, seditious conspiracy to overthrow the U.S. government and its territories. In other words, for struggling for Puerto Rican independence. Now, Oscar grew up in Chicago, and he has not been accused or convicted of any violent act. Yet his refusal to defend himself in a U.S. criminal court and his demand that he be tried as a political prisoner in an international tribunal helped lead to such a disproportionately long sentence. There is currently an international campaign to pressure President Obama to release Oscar from prison before the president leaves office. Many countries, including Greece, have held events in support, and important figures such as Bishop Desmond Tutu and Uruguay's President Pepe Mujica have advocated directly for his release. And in Puerto Rico, support is massive and includes all political and social sectors. Now, Puerto Ricans as a whole do not support independence, at least not openly, because they have been taught that Puerto Rico has no choice but to be associated with the United States, either as a state or in some kind of autonomous association. Yet every single environmental, social, political, and cultural struggle and campaign has had independent supporters as key members. Puerto Rican pride and self-identification with the Puerto Rican nationality is much broader than open support for independence. It's obvious in sports, in music, in cultural celebrations, even in jokes and in everyday life. Even many statehood supporters will often refer to Puerto Rico as their nation, as contradictory as that may sound to outsiders. especially given the recent actions of the United States government and the realization by many Puerto Ricans that Uncle Sam does not have their best interests in mind, it would be interesting to see if independence support would increase should there be a serious proposal that includes indemnification by the U.S. for over a century of colonial rule.
The PROMESA bill has triggered a wave of demonstrations in Puerto Rico all throughout the summer months, which are continuing up until now. How have these protests taken shape?
Well, as soon as Obama signed the bill on June 30th, a number of organizations set up a civil disobedience encampment in front of the main entrance to the federal building in San Juan. Now, this tactic of encampments is a very common feature in activism in Puerto Rico. It serves as a semi-permanent focus for education, organizing, and resistance. It's been used to block environmentally dangerous projects, as well as also the U.S. Navy's former bombing range on Vieques Island, which was a successful struggle. The encampment in front of the federal building has been continuously occupied since the end of June, and it is a focus for seminars, cultural events, picketing, and community building. And for now, the Puerto Rican police have said they do not plan to remove the protesters, although federal agents often conduct provocative actions, such as blasting diesel generators near the tents and walking bomb-sniffing dogs throughout the encampment. Now, on August 31st, just a very, very short time ago, there were massive protests in which successfully blocked a planned conference by the Colonial Chamber of Commerce to promote business opportunities under PROMESA. It was very inspiring to see union members, students, women's groups, and others join together to resist the attempts of opportunists to profit from a dictatorial imposition. The most dramatic moment came when hundreds of riot police tried to force the protesters out of the street, but they were pushed back by people of all ages, despite batons, pepper spray, and brute force. Then several days later, protesters forced the largest Walmart in Puerto Rico to close early. This took place on Labor Day, which was named in Puerto Rico Unemployment Day, since Walmart has destroyed thousands of local businesses. Now, besides the fact that there are more Walmarts per square meter in Puerto Rico than anywhere else, it also receives government incentives, and they recently went to federal court to validate a refusal to pay a reasonable amount of taxes to Puerto Rico. Now, other protests include massive and broad-based movements against the plan by the U.S. government to use military planes to fumigate all of Puerto Rico with dangerous pesticides, supposedly to kill mosquitoes carrying the Zika virus. To this are added a large number of ongoing protests and campaigns, all of which now refer to the coming junta as possibly complicating even more the scenario. Activists in the large Puerto Rican diaspora also hold seminars and stage protests, and many times in coordination with the groups in Puerto Rico. Now, of course, most Puerto Ricans are not protesters, and they try to go about their daily lives while listening with alarm, resignation, or both to the news. Puerto Rican activist organizations face many challenges as they try to work through decades-long factionalism and develop more effective ways to educate the public. Most of all, I think the challenge is not to burn out and to convince others that there's hope.
We are speaking with Professor Deborah Berman Santana here on the Diálogos Radio and the Diálogos interview series. And Deborah, describe the difficulties in forming alliances in Puerto Rico today within this fractured and divided political landscape that you have described.
Well, pro-independence organizations in Puerto Rico have always suffered from severe repression, including efforts by the colonizers, both Spain and the United States, to infiltrate and divide them. Some of the earliest campaigns by the FBI upon its establishment in 1908 included the criminalization and repression of independence activism in Puerto Rico, and such activities continue today. There's a recent example where the FBI grabbed well-known activists in the street and forced them to give DNA samples for supposed ongoing terrorism investigations. Now, this operation included grabbing activists who had previously been imprisoned and for whom the U.S. government would already have had DNA samples. So this is just one example of a century-long campaign of repression that has included murders, disappearances, long incarceration, blacklisting, and spying, The Puerto Rican government also has been complicit in the criminalization of independence, including creating discord among activists and organizations and, of course, blacklisting. But we cannot simply blame outside forces for the divided state of independence and left activism. Besides the personal antagonisms, and many of which are due to the same societal ills that afflict all leftist organizations, such as sexism, there are also ideological disputes, such as the roles of nationalism and socialism in colonial struggles. One new political party in Puerto Rico, for example, declines to take a position on Puerto Rican political status, even though most of its leaders have been identified as independentistas. They expect that by doing so, they can attract pro-statehood workers to vote for them, although I would argue that it would actually repel more statehood supporters because they would be seen as dishonest. Now, of course, this divides the votes of those who no longer want to vote for the two majority parties. The Puerto Rican Independence Party is running a full slate of candidates and is trying to position itself as the alternative. But they, in the past, have also been very sectarian, and they have alienated many independentistas. But despite such divisions, we have seen many activities that include representatives of both parties, as well as other independents and left organizations. And this indicates to me that many people do understand that somehow we need to overcome our divisions, even if we can't overcome our disagreements.
Puerto Rico has often been described as the Greece of the Caribbean. You have had the opportunity to visit Greece twice in the past year, including this past summer. How similar are the crises in the two nations, in your view?
I would say they are strikingly similar, and in fact, that the same playbook is being used in both countries, and despite the differences between the two countries. For example, the acronym TINA, there is no alternative to continued policies of austerity, to privatization, and the increased taxes in order to pay off an unsustainable public debt, is constantly repeated in both places, as is the myth that there is no plan B, and that political independence for both would be disastrous. And of course, in Greece's case, that would be leaving the European Union and leaving the Eurozone. That would be disastrous. As if United States and European Union rule is not already a disaster. In Greece, in addition, there is a proposal currently for an 8-member junta de control fiscal, a fiscal control board named by the EU, which must approve and may even write laws that the Greek government must implement, such as automatic budget cuts and further privatizations. Now, while as a classic colony, Puerto Rico cannot officially deal with the IMF, in practice, the PROMESA bill follows the IMF playbook, as was prescribed by former IMF officials who are hired by the Puerto Rican government, as ordered by their masters in Washington, to produce a report with recommendations for dealing with the debt crisis. In addition, you also see vulture capitalists such as Paul Singer and John Paulson, to name two, swooping into Greece and Puerto Rico to buy up assets such as banks and land, plus debt at a discount. So the fact that Puerto Rico is a classic colony actually makes the problems of our lack of sovereignty much clearer. Greece, of course, is still officially an independent country. So for some people, its de facto colonial status may not be quite as clear. Also, the problem of equating national sovereignty with fascism is particularly acute in Greece, as it's a European country. In Puerto Rico, we have some of that confusion, but it's perhaps not as strong, since in general in Latin America, including in Puerto Rico, there is a tradition of understanding the necessity for national sovereignty as part of an anti-colonial struggle.
We are on the air with Professor Deborah Berman Santana here on the Diálogos Radio and the Diálogos interview series. And Deborah, in your estimation, what is the best solution for Puerto Rico and its people, economically and politically?
Well, the international community recognizes the right of all peoples to self-determination, including freely and unilaterally choosing their political status. There are three recognized statuses. First, union with another independent state under conditions of equality. Second, association with another state with the right to unilaterally change that status. And independence. Now, looking at the United States, The United States has historically added new states only whose native populations were reduced to a small and powerless minority. It has three associated republics, the associated republics of Micronesia, but they complain of a lack of sovereignty and the lack of unwillingness of the United States to renegotiate their compacts. There's also zero interest in the United States to add a new state, which would be comprised of Spanish-speaking people with a distinctly different culture and which additionally has a per capita income which is less than half that of Mississippi, which is the poorest state in the United States. So I believe that political independence represents the only possibility for Puerto Rico to exercise its sovereignty. And it should be accomplished, and I think also with international pressure, as part of a negotiation that includes indemnification for more than a century of colonial exploitation. Certainly, Puerto Rico's colonial debt belongs to the colonizer. So far from seeing independence as separation, as some people would claim, I would argue that it actually opens up Puerto Rico to the rest of the world instead of being chained behind the Iron Curtain of U.S. rule. In Latin America, there is a saying that its independence will not be complete without Puerto Rico. And I believe that time is now.
Before wrapping up, do you have any message that you would like to share with our listeners and with the Greek people?
I would say that I appreciate the solidarity of the people in Greece, much solidarity and much understanding that they showed towards Puerto Rico and when during my visits there. I would encourage the people in Greece to not give up hope and to not accept the notion that there is no alternative to the ongoing loss of sovereignty and the ongoing economic deterioration that you're facing. There's always hope, but also love of country is not necessarily fascist. We have to say that here in Puerto Rico as well. And basically, free people and free countries, their individual freedom and freedom of peoples goes together. I don't think you can separate one from the other. And I have much love for the people of Greece and for all people of in solidarity everywhere. Viva Puerto Rico Libre.
Well, Deborah, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today here on the Diálogos Radio and the Diálogos interview series, and for sharing with us your experiences from both Puerto Rico and Greece.
Thank you very much.
The podcast of today's interview will soon be available on our website, dialogosmedia.org, through the Diálogos Radio apps for Android, Kindle, BlackBerry, and Chrome, in iTunes, TuneIn.com, and the Windows Marketplace, and in Anobex Radio, WeCast, Player FM, Stitcher, and Podbean apps for various mobile devices. Coming up next is our commentary of the week. Diálogos Radio's Commentary of the Week. Each week, Michael Navratakis provides views and opinions on issues pertaining to Greece and to the worldwide Greek community. Coming up next, here on Diálogos Radio. Not so long ago, but certainly in a galaxy far, far away, the purported Prime Minister of Greece gave his State of the Union address and told the masses just how great everything in Greece is under the tenure of the Syriza-led coalition government in Greece. At least, one has to assume that Alexis Tsipras does indeed reside in a galaxy far, far away if he believes all of the nonsense he spouted recently during his annual speech at the Thessaloniki Trade Fair. Why, according to Tsipras, salaries are going up, unemployment is going down, he's going to give raises, he's going to provide more jobs, schools and public services are all functioning better than ever before, tourism is arriving in Greece in record numbers, and Greece has finally turned the corner and is headed towards perpetual growth, stability, and sustainability. That's Fantasy Island. Now here's reality. There's a story of the elderly woman in Greece who relies upon an oxygen concentrator to live, but who had her electricity cut off while her son was arrested for protesting this action. There was a street vendor selling pastries on the street and whose spouse is unemployed, who was fined 5,000 euros for unlicensed operation as part of the government's supposed crusade against purported tax evaders. Not too far from home in Athens, 17 out of 22 storefronts lie vacant in a three-block 4-block stretch, which also includes a park that is chained shut and filled with overgrown weeds. On the island of Samos, German police patrol a main port in uniform, while in the mountain villages, residents and shop owners listen to Turkish radio because no reception of Greek stations is possible. This is reality, and it is reality in a country that is not ruled by Syriza or Alexis Tsipras, but by those whom the government turned the keys of the country over to formally earlier this year. I am speaking of the European Commission, the European Central Bank, the European Stability Mechanism, which holds control over all Greek public assets for at least the next 99 years, and the International Monetary Fund. None of this, though, made it into Tsipras's recent address. Instead, in Greece, the sell-off continues, as with the recent privatization of the entire national railway, including all of the infrastructure, stations, buildings, rails, trains, and everything else, for a mere 45 million euros debt-free. The site of the former international airport of Athens, which was once slated to become the largest urban park in Europe, was sold off at a bargain basement price, soon to become the home of casinos and shopping malls. Public water utilities are next in line to be sold off, despite Syriza's pre-election promises to halt and to reverse all of these privatizations, which it is now pursuing with zeal. Tax increases are pursued with equally enthusiastic zeal. The same unified property tax which Syriza and her governing partners, the independent Greeks, once denounced as unconstitutional, while instructing citizens how to avoid paying it, will once again be enforced this year with 7 in 10 businesses facing increases. Greek citizens will soon be forced to declare all of their assets, right down to family heirlooms and even, quite literally, the amount of cash in their pockets, as part of a nationwide asset registry that is being developed, in conjunction with a national transaction registry where every bank transaction and every purchase will be tracked. Never mind that Greek citizens are already unable to keep up with this barrage of taxes, as evidenced by the 1 billion euro shortfall in tax receipts just in the first half of this year. The tax avalanche is accompanied by further cuts to pensions, which were cut earlier in the summer by as much as half, and which are about to be slashed further. In response to the cuts, Yorgos Katrugalos, the labor minister who participated in the 2011 protests of the anti-austerity indignant movement, stated that the new system will, quote, protect all Greeks from poverty, adding that had pensions not been reduced, they will not be issued at all. The number of employed workers who remain unpaid has in the meantime topped 1 million, while 500,000 Greeks are paid less than 412 euros per month for their labor. Only 4.3% of those unemployed were able to find jobs, according to the most recent statistics. Businesses have had their taxes increased, to which Hara Kafandari, a member of parliament with Syriza, cynically stated that the days where a shop owner was his own boss are over. Businesses, families, and degree holders are being driven out of Greece, citizens literally being driven out of their homes in many cases, as the government is expecting to collect over 2 billion euros from home foreclosures and confiscations by the end of this year. And as all of this is going on, Syriza, from its headquarters on Fantasy Island, has the audacity to continue to claim that it has been meeting its pre-election pledges. Case in point, the recent television licensing bid. One of Syriza's numerous pre-election pledges was to rout the oligarchs who control the media. Recently, the Syriza government triumphantly claimed to have fulfilled this promise through the completion of the auctioning process for 4 licenses for national general interest television stations. This announcement was accompanied by claims that fairness and rule of law had been restored after 27 years of lawlessness, as broadcasters have, up until now, been operating under a framework of provisional legality. In reality, though, the process was rife with illegalities and completely lacked transparency. It has also put 6 of Greece's 8 largest private television broadcasters in danger of being forced off the air by year's end. Most significantly, perhaps, is the fact that the licensing process was conducted by the government itself, instead of by Greece's independent licensing body for broadcasters, the National Commission for Radio and Television, which has remained defunct for most of the past year. This contradicts both the Greek constitution and European regulations, which call for licensing processes to be conducted by independent bodies. The bid was based on a false premise that there were only enough frequencies available to license 4 national privately owned broadcasters, 2 frequencies with 2 HD outlets each. This claim is contradicted by the hundreds of digital stations broadcasting in Italian cities and the multiple HD channels per frequency on Britain's Freeview service. The licensing process also did not include any criteria whatsoever for the quality of programming, for balanced news presentation, or for public service programming. The only criterion which mattered was money, and with a limited amount of licenses being issued, the cost of each license was artificially driven upward, ensuring only the deepest of deep pockets, oligarchs in other words, could participate. And just who are the oligarchs who successfully bid for licenses? Two of them, Yanis Alafouzos and Theodoros Kyriakou, own incumbent broadcaster Sky TV and Antenna TV, respectively. These two stations led the vociferous pro-yes, pro-austerity media brigade prior to the July 2015 referendum. Alafouzos, a ship owner, was found to be in possession of over 50 million euros in undeclared funds and had his assets frozen last month, pending an investigation for tax evasion. One of Sky's main commentators, Babis Papadimitriou, is notorious for having suggested that the previous conservative government of New Democracy could benefit from forming a coalition with a, quote, serious Golden Dawn, Greece's far-right party. Antenna, like Sky, also fanatically supported the pro-austerity yes vote in the 2015 referendum, likening the yes versus no option to a choice between being like Europe or becoming Zimbabwe. The cases of the other two licensees, neither of whom are currently in possession of a television station, are even more egregious. One of the winning bidders is Vangelis Marinakis, a shipping mogul and football magnate who is facing at least five criminal investigations on charges ranging from match fixing to directing a criminal organization. Marinakis is also said to have been involved in a case of the Nour 1, a ship which Greek authorities found to be transporting 2.1 tons of heroin and which may be linked to Marinakis through close associates of his. Marinakis is also a city councilman in Piraeus, while his right-hand man from the Olympiakos football club, Yanis Morales, is mayor. Recently, prosecutors in Greece recommended that Marinakis be jailed pending trial on charges of match-fixing. But perhaps the most flagrant case of all is that of Christos Kalogritsas, a former publisher-turned-construction magnate, and his son, Ioannis Vladimiros Kalogritsas. Christos Kalogritsas' construction firm, Toxotis, is the recipient of numerous state contracts issued by the Syriza-led government for public works projects throughout Greece. Toxotis recently purchased Medusa, a competing construction firm. This firm was formerly known as Tsipras ATE and was owned by Pavlos Tsipras, the father of current Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras. Christos Kalogritsas and his wife are currently facing civil and criminal charges for an alleged 51 million euros in unpaid taxes. The Kalogritsas family also owns significant shares in Attica Bank, one of the banks which has been repeatedly recapitalized by Greek taxpayers. It is from Attica Bank that Ioannis Vladimiros Kalogritsas provided a letter of guarantee worth 3 million euros in order to participate in the television licensing bid. This letter was submitted past the deadline set by the government for participation in the bid, but was nevertheless accepted. Additionally, Christos Kalogritsas has close ties to current defense minister Panos Kamenos and the current minister of infrastructure, transport, and networks, Christos Spiridis, whose ministry oversees both public works projects and matters pertaining to broadcast frequency allocation. Kalogritsas is also said to maintain a, quote, brotherly friendship with current minister of state Nikos Papas, who oversaw the television licensing process. He's also a primary shareholder of polling firm GPO, one of the many Greek polling firms which receive state funding and which has repeatedly produced grossly inaccurate public opinion and exit poll results. Further adding to the web of corruption, both Marinakis and the Kalogritsas family are represented by the attorney Yanis Manzouranis. Manzouranis also happened to represent the Greek state in a recent television licensing process. Clearly, conflicts of interest are not a concern for Syriza. In the late 1980s, Manzouranis had been jailed as part of the wide-ranging Koskotas money laundering scandal. He is also one of the attorneys of investigative journalist turned Syriza cheerleader Kostas Vaxevanis, who through his involvement in the Elasinet network of regional television stations, stands to be one of the beneficiaries of any bid for regional TV licenses. All of this has taken place while 1,000 to 2,000 employees in the television sector face unemployment if their stations are forced to close. This would also create a restricted and highly centralized and controlled television market. Tsipras, in a recent speech celebrating the opening of a new stretch of highway constructed by Toxotis, promised to turn over the 246 million euros in revenue from the licensing bid, quote, to the poor. Of course, this assumes that the money, which would be paid in three annual installments and only if the stations are profitable, is ever paid. Even so, EU officials have already stated that it will go toward Greece's commitments to its lenders and not to the impoverished. The EU has also questioned the licensing process itself. Tsipras also omitted from his speech the loss of tax receipts and insurance fund contributions from the six nations slated to shut down, and he combined 700 million euros in debts they owe to Greek banks, which would likely go unpaid if they go off the air and be thrust upon the shoulders of Greek taxpayers instead via yet another recapitalization. And make no mistake, Syriza's efforts are not just contained to broadcast licensing. Syriza intends to create a state-run body to allocate advertising across media outlets, retaining a 30% commission for the state. Earlier in the year, government spokeswoman Olga Yerovasili announced the government's intention to, quote, restore order to the internet, beginning with the creation of a registry of online news outlets and blogs. Registration was mandatory for all outlets which wished to be considered for state advertising expenditures, an easy way for any government to pay its way into the hearts of media owners. This, ladies and gentlemen, is Syriza, the same Syriza where the vice president of the government, Yanis Dragasakis, has stated that it was a mistake for Syriza to have demonized the word memorandum. Syriza member of parliament Magis Balauras recently claimed that austerity is not in Syriza's DNA. Economist Rania Andonopoulou, who holds the ironic portfolio of, quote, alternate minister for combating unemployment, recently wrote in a Syriza-owned Avi newspaper that, quote, the third memorandum has strengthened Greece's position. In a let-em-eat-cake moment, Deputy Minister for Social Solidarity Theanos Fotiou remarked that, quote, stuffed peppers could feed an entire family. Over the summer, the government proudly proclaimed the, quote, loosening of stifling capital controls as the restriction on bank withdrawals was changed from 420 euros weekly to an 840 euro cap every 2 weeks. Do the math. Schools go without janitorial staffs, while university restrooms go without toilet paper. All of this while there is nary a thought of departing the Eurozone or following the example of British voters and waving goodbye to the European Union. In this modern-day debt colony, the so-called leftist government has demonstrated an astonishing arrogance in not only violating its pre-election promises, July 2015 referendum result, and agreeing to a third, and the most onerous to date, austerity program, but also continuing to pretend that it is acting in a leftist and progressive manner. All the while, it's keeping Greece firmly shackled to the chains of the European Union, Eurozone, and IMF, while the Greek people seemingly have lost their pluck, devoid of any fight, resigned to their EU shackles. This is the Alagos Radio, where today's broadcast will soon come to a close. We're changing things around this season, as we will be alternating across much of our network of stations, our English language broadcasts with our Greek language edition on a weekly basis, with the same great programming, interviews, commentary, and music on both editions. You can also check out the Alagos in print, including our recent analysis for Mint Press News on the current highlights, or rather lowlights, of the Syriza-led government in Greece in a major television licensing scandal. You can find our analysis, as well as our podcasts and archives, plus our online radio station, the Alagos Radio 24/7, on our website, thealagosmedia.org. This has been the Alagos Radio with Michael Nevradakis. Thanks for joining us.
Ήλισο, θα σου πω το μικρό μου μυστικό. Σ' αγαπώ, σ' αγαπώ. Τα μωρά φωνάζουν τη μαμά τους, μα εγώ είμαι έρμο και ορφανό. Τα πουλιά πετούν με τα φτερά τους, μα εγώ πετώ μες στο χώρο. Πώς τον λένε, πώς τον λένε τον ποταμό. Μιλήσω, μιλήσω. Θα σου πω το μικρό μου μυστικό. Σ' αγαπώ, σ' αγαπώ. Κάθε κοπέλα θέλει να έχει φίλο τον όμορφο θέλει και να βγαίνει μαζί του τα βραδιά. Να έχει καρδιά, να έχει καρδιά. Όμως καθένας γνωρίζει πόσο θέλει πολύ συνηθίζει. Κάθε βράδυ κορίτσι να αλλάζει. Δεν με νοιάζει, δεν με νοιάζει. Πώς τον λένε, πώς τον λένε τον ποταμό. Ηλισσό, ηλισσό. θα σου πω το μικρό μου μυστικό. Αγαπώ, σ' αγαπώ. Τα μωρά φωνάζουν μαμά τους, μα εγώ είμαι ερμό κι ορφανό. Τα πουλιά πετούν με τα φτερά τους, μα εγώ πετώ μες στο χώρο. Πώς τον λένε τον ποταμό, Ήλισσο, Ήλισσο. Θα σου πω το μικρό μου μυστικό. Σ' αγαπώ, σ' αγαπώ.